It's a good thing we're not playing Simon Says, because Simon didn't say be seated. Everybody would have gotten in trouble on that one. You know, that Simon Says is an interesting game. It is both a listening activity and an obedience activity, and a game that teaches the concept of authority. Of course, I don't know who Simon is or why he's important to listen to, but when it comes to spiritual things, when it comes to our Christian lives, we need to be looking for what did Jesus say. So many times people listen to everyone and everything else, and someone says jump and they jump, and someone says do this and they do that, and they do all these things, and yet that's not what Jesus said. We need to look to our Lord and Savior to learn what He wants us to do. So let's continue looking at that in Matthew chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16, we had finished with verse 20 last time. We'll start with verse 21, and we'll get on into chapter 17 tonight as we look at some more of Jesus' teachings. We want to get to know Jesus. It is, without a doubt, one of the saddest things in our society that most people know more about their favorite sports star, movie star, music star, whatever else it might be, politician, whatever, that they know more about that person than they do about Jesus. Our society has an idea in their head, everyone does, of what Jesus is and what Jesus is like and what Jesus thinks and wants, and so many times it's so far from who Jesus really was according to the Scriptures. When He lived on this earth, He was far different from what most people think He was. And we need to study the New Testament to learn about the real Jesus. He's not the one that people picture in movies or that is living in people's imaginations. So many times He's so different from that. Now Jesus had just finished telling the disciples not to tell anyone He was the Christ because it wasn't the time yet. It wasn't time for people to know that yet. He still had the rest of His mission to fulfill, although the time is getting close. And in fact, in verse 21, from that time, you know, they talked about Him building the church, and Peter had made that great confession that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And from that time, verse 21 tells us, Jesus began to show to His disciples how He must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised again the third day. Now, up to this time, Jesus had not spent much time talking about those things. There were other things that He had to focus on, other things they had to learn. But now, as the time is drawing near, He's got to impress upon them what's going to happen. He has to help them understand that He has to die, but that's not the end, that He's going to rise again. Even though He spends some time trying to teach them that, they still don't get it. Do you remember what happened after He died, after they put Him in the tomb? Well, the disciples were all distraught, and they all thought that was the end. Well, Peter says, well, let's go fishing. Go back to what we were doing before. I guess it's all over. We have to consider that Jesus had an uphill battle. All of the teaching in His day about the Messiah was that the Messiah was going to come like David in his kingdom with military might, and He was going to kick out the Romans, and He was going to take over, and they were going to again have the great days of Solomon, where the nation of Israel was powerful and wealthy and everyone looked to them. They hadn't read all of Isaiah, because Isaiah had prophesied about the suffering servant that was going to come, the one by whose stripes we would be healed. But they had ignored that part. They didn't listen to that part. They only saw the part about where He was going to be the mighty God who was going to come, and He was going to be wonderful Counselor and the Prince of Peace, and they were going to have peace, and it was going to be all so wonderful. They would be a world power again, like they were back in the days of David and Solomon. And so Jesus had an uphill battle to try to teach His disciples that that's not the way it's going to be. Instead of me coming in on a white horse and saving the day, I'm going to come in carrying a cross out. And that's how I'm going to save the day. That's how I'm going to save the world. And so He began to talk to them about His death and about His coming suffering that He was going to have to face. Now Peter, if you're a normal human being, you just have to love Peter. You have to identify with him, because Peter's so much like us. It seems like sometimes he has these bursts of brilliance and you think, wow, where did that come from? And then the next time he opens his mouth, he inserts both feet up to the knees. Peter had just a little while back, just a few verses ago, been blessed by Jesus. Blessed art thou, Simon, son of John, Bar-Jonah. For flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven. And then he starts telling Peter about the keys to the kingdom and all of these wonderful things. And I don't know if Peter just got the big head from that compliment that Jesus gave him or what. But here, as Jesus begins to tell them how he's going to have to suffer and die, Peter, you can't fault him for nerve. Peter was no coward, will I tell you. He takes Jesus aside and he begins to rebuke Jesus. He's going to correct Jesus. Oh no, Lord, that's never going to happen to you. Well, who's going to stop it, Peter? You going to stop that? This has been God's plan since before the foundation of the world. But Peter, no, he's going to stop that from happening. I don't know who he thinks he is or what he thinks this situation's all about, but he's a little confused. But we all kind of get there sometimes where we get too big for our britches and we speak out on things we shouldn't. We've all been there. Jesus turns around to him. And the very same fellow who had just been blessed by Jesus a little while ago is now called Satan. Get behind me, Satan. And the very person who a little while ago was told that the Father in heaven had revealed these things to him is now told, you don't savor, you don't enjoy the flavor of the things of God, but you're too worldly, you're too interested in the things of man. Completely different conversation than the one we studied last week, isn't it? It's like night and day. You wonder if it's the same Peter. You wonder, was he demon-possessed? Did he change it? No, it's the same guy. But you know, all of us seem to have within us these these things go on, where just that quickly we can seem like a different person. We can be that far off when we were that right a minute ago. And we have to beware of that. And of course we have to watch out for pride and arrogance, because those are the things that often come right before the fall. Those are the things that are a struggle for us. How quickly we humans can fall into Satan's clutches. That's why, you know, when Peter warns in his book that he wrote about how we need to beware because Satan is walking about like a roaring lion seeking who he can devour, Peter had first-hand experience with that, didn't he? He knew what he was talking about because he'd been there. He'd been the one that Satan was getting and that Satan was using. And you notice, this may be this another of Jesus' temptations that he faces. Satan certainly came and tempted Jesus three times. We saw that back in Matthew chapter 4. Those weren't the only three temptations Jesus faced. Here, Satan tries to get at Jesus through one of his closest associates, one of his closest, dearest friends. And so many times, Satan will use our own friends and family against us to get to us. And that's just what he did with Jesus and Peter here. And Jesus goes on then in verse 24 to a different topic. You know, it's always amazing. Jesus was quick to rebuke somebody if they needed rebuking. He was quick to honor them if they needed to be honored. When it was over, he moved on. He didn't dwell on Peter's mistake here. He didn't come back to it 6 months later or, you know, on and on again about it like some of us sometimes do. He did the correcting. He pointed out the fault. And then he moved on. And he goes on to say then in verse 24, "If anyone will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Luke, in referencing a similar thing about taking up the cross, he says, "Let him take up his cross daily." It's not just a one-time thing that we take up the cross to follow Jesus. It has to be a daily thing. Every day. Jesus makes it clear there is a deep commitment that's necessary to please Him. Not just halfway, not just give Him part, not just give Him most, not even 99%. Jesus says you must deny yourself. You've got to take up your cross. You've got to follow me. You've got to give 100%. It's all or nothing. Jesus wants us to know that no matter what goes on, we have to come after Him. We have to stick with Him. We have to beware. There are so many in the religious world today that want to paint a picture that if you follow Jesus, everything will be a bed of roses without thorns. It'll all be rose petals. It'll all be sunshine. It'll all be wonderful. Everything will be perfect. They're liars. That's not what Jesus said. Jesus said, if you come after me, you've got to take up a cross. And He didn't mean a little gold cross that hangs around your neck. Not that there's necessarily anything wrong with having a little gold cross that hangs around your neck, but that's not what He's talking about. When He says you've got to take up your cross, what was the cross? The cross was an instrument of torture and execution. And Jesus says, that's what you've got to take up. And you better follow me carrying that cross. We need to consider what kind of sacrifices Jesus really calls on us to make. He really calls on us to deny everything about ourselves and suffer anything for Him. Well, it's not all sunshine and flowers. It's not all happy, good things happening all the time. Now, there is a deep sense of joy and peace that can come from following Christ. But bad things will still happen to us. You realize that these very 12 that He's speaking to, one of them betrayed Him and committed suicide. But of the other 11, as far as we know from secular history, because the Bible only records the fate of one, and that's James. He was beheaded pretty early on. But the rest, from secular history, from traditions of history, indicate that other than John, all the rest of them were also executed for their faith in Christ. So he wasn't talking about this was going to be an easy path to follow. No, no. He indicates that instead it was going to be a difficult path to follow. Now, that might scare some people away. Oh, well, I don't want to go then. If it does, so be it. Jesus is not out to win a popularity contest. He's out to find those who are willing to be devoted to Him all the way. And that's what we need to be if we're going to please Him. In verse 25, he says, "Whoever will save his life will lose it. Whoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it." If any aspect of our life, whether it's physical, social, our family life, our financial life, any aspect of our life, if it is too dear to us for us to give up, then we've already lost our life. We've got to be willing to give up any of it. We've got to be willing to give up all of it, if need be. In the early centuries, there were those who were honored by the church. They were called confessors because they would confess that Jesus was the Christ in spite of persecution. But there were others who, at the point where their life was threatened, in order to save their lives, their physical lives, they would deny Christ. They'd buckle under the pressure. They'd fold like a house of cards. And I know that none of us can really know what we would do if we were faced with that circumstance. But we need to determine in our mind that we want to be faithful to Him no matter what. And that if we were ever faced with that circumstance, that we know what we ought to do. We know that there's no excuse for denying Him, even at the point a life is threatened, whether it's our life or the lives of a loved one. Whatever the case may be, we cannot deny the Lord. Not if we want to please Him. In verse 26, Jesus points out the value of a human soul. I don't know what the value of everything on this earth is. I suppose it would be in the multiple trillions, quadrillions of dollars if we could put it into monetary amounts. Who knows how far it would go. I know that our own nation's value is multiple trillions of dollars, the industry, the resources that we have, and there are many more untapped resources that we don't even know their value, I'm sure. And throughout the world, no telling what the value of that if you could put a dollar amount on it. But regardless of how astronomical that figure is, Jesus says that one soul is more valuable than all of it. If you could have all of the gold and all of the silver, all of the plutonium, all of the oil, all of the coal, all of everything that this world has to offer, all of the farms, all of the land, all of the fish of the sea, if you had it all and you lost your soul, it was a bad bargain, Jesus said. And He asked the question then, really a haunting question for each and every one of us, one that we need to constantly consider. What will a man exchange for his soul? What would I give up? Or what would I give my soul up for? What would I give up to gain my soul? What would I give up my soul in order to gain? Would I do it for $1 million or $10 million? Would I do it to get to be the president? Would I do it in order to get to be some famous person on television? What would I give up my soul for those things? Would I do it to have peace with a family member that does not believe in the Lord? Would I give up my soul in order to have that peace with that person? What would I do? What would I trade? What would I give up for my soul, or what would I give up my soul for? That's the question that we need to ask. Now, quickly, of course, we would say, well, what would you trade your soul for? We say, well, nothing. Nothing. No, I wouldn't want to trade my soul. And yet, so many people have. They've traded their soul for drugs or alcohol. They've traded their souls for a few moments of pleasure. They've traded their soul for a raise or a promotion or a friendship. So many things that people trade their soul for. They leave God. They deny Christ for something else. We need to consider that. Now, in verse 27, Jesus explains that there is going to be a time when the Son of Man will come with His angels. And when He does that, He's going to reward every man according to his works. So He says, ultimately, there's going to come a day of accounting. There's going to come a day where you're going to stand and be judged. This obviously is a reference to the judgment, the time when Jesus is going to come with the angels. And the angels are going to be the reapers, the parable of the sower told us. The parable of the tares. That at the end of time, the reapers are going to come, those angels, they're going to come and they're going to gather the wheat into the barn, and then they're going to take the chaff and it's going to be carried to the fire. And Jesus says there's coming a day when that's going to happen. But so that the disciples don't get confused about His coming kingdom and the final judgment, because there seems to be that they kind of sometimes get that a little confused based on some questions that they ask over in Matthew 23 and 24 and 25. There's some more discussion of this very thing because they still hadn't got it straight. But Jesus tries to avoid some confusion in verse 28 because He says, "Verily I say unto you, there be some standing here that shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man come in His kingdom." So He lets them know the kingdom's going to come first, but there is going to be a day when everyone's going to be judged according to their works. That's going to be the final judgment after death or after Jesus returns again with His angels. But He says, now the kingdom, though, is coming, and some who are standing here are still going to be alive to see that. They're not going to face death before that event occurs. Now, Jesus and the disciples are all standing there. Why do you suppose He says there are some standing here that shall not taste of death? Because there were some standing there that were going to taste of death before that happened. Jesus and Judas would both be dead. They would both die before that event took place. Jesus, of course, would be raised again, but Judas would not. And so Jesus says, some, those standing here, will not taste death till it happens. And of course, the day of Pentecost is the reference of that time when the kingdom came. It's interesting, all the way up through the Gospels, leading up to Acts chapter 2, the kingdom is spoken of in the future as something that's coming. But after Acts chapter 2, the kingdom is spoken of as something that is here. It's something that is presently in existence. The premillennialists miss that. They think the kingdom is something that's still going to come. That's not the case. Several times, Paul, for example, says in Colossians that He has translated us into the kingdom of His dear Son. It's already there. John says, "I am your companion in tribulation and in the kingdom." He said, "I'm already in the kingdom, and so are you." And so we need to recognize that was the day, that was the place and the time where those things that had been prophesied before came to pass, and the kingdom began that day. Peter, of course, preaching that first gospel sermon and using those keys to the kingdom that Jesus had promised in the past few verses to open the doors to that kingdom to let people come in. As we move into chapter 17 then, it's almost a week later. Perhaps the disciples have forgotten some of these things. We tend to forget things. How many of us remember what we talked about last Sunday? It's been a week. We forget those things. And so it's possible that they've forgotten some of the things that Jesus had talked about. But He takes Peter and James and John up onto a high mountain. Just the three of them with Jesus. Many times those three are invited when none of the others are. And as they're up there on top of that mountain, and this we often refer to this as the Transfiguration, which is a word that honestly we probably don't even know what it means half the time. It's just, well, yes, on the Mount of Transfiguration. Transfiguration, that's a weird word. Not one you probably used this past week. But what it literally means when we think of a figure, like a drawing, and we think of trans means to change, or to go across, or to do differently. And so, this transfiguration, He changed His figure. He changed His appearance, in essence, is what it is. And Jesus' appearance changed so that it was bright like the sun, and His clothing was white like light. But more than that happened. That alone would have been quite an experience in and of itself to see Him with this glorious appearance. But that's just the beginning. There was more. They saw Elijah and Moses talking with Him as well. These two men who had been gone from the earth for several hundred years were all of a sudden standing there on that mountain talking with Jesus right in front of them. Even in this experience where they see Jesus changed in this way, they're not seeing His full, true, godly form. They're seeing some of His glory radiate, but they're not still seeing Him truly as He is in heaven now. He was still in the form of the Jesus that they recognized, only brighter, glowing. And you know, Jesus, interestingly enough, didn't look like that all the time. You know, we see the paintings in all the old cathedrals and all the artwork and from years gone by, and they have Jesus just glowing in this radiant look and this halo above His head. And we think, well, you know, if Jesus walked around looking like that, how come people didn't know who He was? Well, He didn't walk around looking like that. He normally looked just like any other Jew of His day and time. He wasn't in any way distinguishable specifically from others. I mean, He was an individual, but He didn't have this huge glow about Him or this halo over His head so people would recognize Him. That's not the case. And so this rare occasion here where they see Him with this glow and this light, Moses and Elijah talking with Him, Matthew doesn't tell us, but Luke chapter 9 and verse 31 tells us what they were talking about. They were talking about Jesus' upcoming death. They were talking about what He was going to have to face. An interesting group here. Moses, who had died all alone, just him and God, and had been buried by God, and Elijah, who had never died, are here talking with the Son of God about His death. Wonder what that conversation was like. Wonder what they said. Wonder what insight Moses had to give on that topic. Wonder what Elijah had to say about never having died. Wonder what feelings about that event that was coming up Jesus expressed to them. The Bible doesn't tell us. Sometimes we're left wondering. God only tells us those things that we need to know, not those things that we want to know. He'll give us something to want to ask when we get to heaven. Although I wonder but what we'll forget all of those petty little questions when we get there, being awed by the experience of being in heaven with God. Moses and Elijah both had passed from earthly life in different ways, of course, but now they're still very much alive and very much aware of what's going on, enough to talk about what's about to happen with Jesus. This kind of puts to rest, so to speak, the theory of soul sleep that some religious groups claim, that when the righteous die, they sleep and they don't know anything and they don't know what's going on. It doesn't seem to be the case. Moses and Elijah knew what was going on, and they're here discussing that with the Lord. In another occasion where someone came back from the dead to visit but not to stay, Samuel talked to Saul and told him what was going to happen to him and his sons the next day. He knew. He knew about the battle that was about to take place. And he was not ignorant of that as someone who was sleeping would have been. Moses, of course, represents the law that he was the penman of. Elijah, representative of the prophets of God. The law and the prophets. And so when Peter looks up and he sees these three standing there, and he knows the Lord and apparently recognizes Moses and Elijah from something that has occurred, whether through appearance or through something that was spoken. Perhaps their names were even mentioned in the conversation. I don't know how he knew them, but he knew them. And he says, hey, let's build one tabernacle for you, Jesus, and we'll build one for Moses, and we'll build one for Elijah. And he's got this grand plan. And before he can even finish laying out his plan, the Father from heaven interrupts him. It says that a bright cloud overshadowed them. I don't know how you have a bright cloud. Most clouds are kind of dark. But this bright cloud overshadowed them. It's kind of like how hell can be a place of fire and yet be total darkness. God is able to do these things that to us may seem paradoxical. And yet here's this bright cloud and this voice that comes out from it and says, "This is my beloved Son. Hear Him." And to all of us still today, the Father says, "Listen to my Son." The Hebrew writer says, in times past, God has spoken through His prophets, but now He speaks through His Son. And that's it. That's who we need to listen to. And then Moses and Elijah disappear. And the authority of Moses' law and the prophets has also disappeared today. We need not go back to that. It's gone. God's Son is the one that we are to listen to today. They're afraid. They fall down on their faces. Now, notice, they saw Jesus glowing like the sun. They didn't fall down on their faces. They saw two people who had not lived on earth for hundreds of years suddenly appear and start talking with Jesus. They didn't fall down afraid or pass out. They hear God's voice from heaven and they fall flat on their face. That's not an unusual response. Back in the book of Exodus, in Exodus 20 and 19, when God came down, He was going to come down and speak to the children of Israel. And the children of Israel were so frightened by Him that they begged Moses, "Please, you speak to us for God. Don't let Him speak to us or we'll die." That's how frightful they were. Now, why do we mention that? How many people have you run across today in our world who say, "Well, you know, God told me," and they just nonchalantly mention it as though, you know, like they had a phone conversation with somebody. Like they just bumped into an old friend and had a nice chat. When God speaks, it is a frightful experience. The disciples fall face first on the ground And Jesus has to come over to them and touch them and say, get up, don't be afraid. And then when they look up, it's just Jesus back to His normal appearance again. If we understand the Scriptures, if we read what the Bible says about these things, then when folks are telling, well, God spoke to me and He said this or that or the other thing, if we understand the Scriptures, we immediately are going to doubt that. It's incredible that they would just casually mention, oh, God spoke to me. It's not that kind of an event. When God speaks, it is an event that is shocking, awe-inspiring. I know we use the word awesome to describe a lot of things. Oh, that meal was awesome. Oh, that car is awesome. Oh, that game was awesome. Oh, this, that, or the other thing was awesome. It's used so lightly, really. But God is truly awesome. The word awesome literally refers to inspiring awe, inspiring an attitude of amazement and even worship. And the disciples, hearing God's voice, were frightened by it. Jesus comes to comfort them, and you know, John tells us in 1 John 4:18 that perfect love casts out fear. It seems as human beings, we're never quite able to reach that perfection, that perfect love. Because even though John said that in 1 John 4, in Revelation 1:17, when he, in his vision, in the revelation, witnesses the scene in heaven and sees Jesus, he records that he fell down as one dead. He's frightened to the point. He just his knees buckle and he just falls out like somebody dead. He just passed out there. And again, in that situation, Jesus had to say, "Don't be afraid." Well, even the disciple whom Jesus loved, even one who loved Jesus and knew that perfect love ought to cast out fear, still, when faced with that amazing appearance in Revelation, was still afraid. A frightful appearance. Of course, if you read that description of Jesus there in Revelation 1, if you walked up into a scene and had that person appear before you, if you're in your right mind, you'd probably be frightened by that experience as well. It wasn't your routine experience that he saw. But as Jesus then gets them and they head back down the mountain, after His authority has been impressed upon them by the voice of the Father, He tells them not to mention what they've seen until after His resurrection. Again, it's not time yet. There are certain things that it wasn't the right time for. Now, they're a little confused then because they said, you know, I remember back in Sunday school. Well, they probably didn't remember in Sunday school, but they may have remembered in Sabbath school. I remember back when the scribes would teach, you know, when we'd go to the temple or we'd go to the tabernacle or whatever, the scribes would tell us that Elijah was supposed to come first. And so they said, why did they say that? Why did they say Elijah's supposed to come first? If this is all going to happen and you're going to die and be resurrected, they said Elijah's supposed to come first. And so Jesus says, you know, the scribes were right. Elijah was supposed to come first. And then he goes on to say, in fact, that Elijah did come before Christ. And that when Elijah came, and he's already come, Jesus says, they didn't recognize him. And so they did whatever they wanted to with him, and in essence, they killed him. And then Jesus says that he's going to have to suffer the same way. They're going to hurt him too. They're going to destroy him physically as well. The disciples, those three, then realized that Jesus was talking about John. the immerser, John the Baptist. He was the Elijah that was to have come, and he had already come. And they recognized the course of events. And that the religious leaders did not recognize John as the one crying in the wilderness. He even said that's who he was. They came and asked him, "Are you the Christ?" He said, "No." "Are you this or that?" He said, "No." They said, "Well, who are you? What do you say about yourself?" And he said, "I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness. Make straight the paths of the Lord." And that's what Elijah was going to come and say when he came. He was going to be the voice of one crying in the wilderness. He was going to make the path straight. He was going to restore Israel. And that's what John did. And we said, "Well, wait a minute. But if he was supposed to restore Israel, then how come there were still so many who didn't believe in Jesus when he came?" Ah. See, that's where we need to learn the difference between those who were Israel by flesh and those who were Israel spiritually. In fact, Paul spends a great deal of time talking about the difference in the physical Israel, the physical nation of the Jews, and the spiritual Israel. John restored all of the spiritual Israel back to the right path and prepared them for the coming of the Messiah. Those who rejected John's warnings and John's exhortations and John's teachings and John's pointing them to the Lamb and the Messiah, they missed out. I hope that none of us will miss out. Elijah's not coming back again to point us in the right direction. We now already have the Christ. How well do we know Him? How well do we know what He wants of us? Are we ready to sacrifice ourselves, to deny ourselves for Him? Are we willing to give up everything to save our souls with Him? Or are we willing to sacrifice our soul to gain something here on this earth that will not last and that will disappear when this world disappears, if not before? Do we need to respond to God's invitation? If you have a need to come for any reason, either in repentance or for prayers to be stronger, to develop your faith deeper, whatever reason you might have, respond please as we stand and sing.